Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The earth moves, the world watches, the people of Chile wait. This woman near the epicenter is arguing that what police call looters are just taking necessities. An estimated 2 million displaced people in Chile await assistance from the Chilean government from a combination earthquake tsunami, far more powerful but less deadly than the catastrophe in Haiti. Perils on the Pacific Rim. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, March 1st. Lynn Scherr is with me for one more day while Celeste Headlee is out. And, you know, once again, pictures of earthquakes, pictures of discussion of building codes, Richter scales, those kinds of things.
But astonishingly, so totally different from what we saw in Haiti.
The energy in a quake doesn't necessarily determine the devastation in human terms.
A real tribute to the people who made the building codes in Chile.
Indeed. And it's all unfolding in the next few hours.
Let's get right to that and some of the other top stories we're following this morning. The government in Chile is trying to get a handle on the devastation following Saturday's earthquake, the seventh strongest ever on record, 500 times more powerful than the one in Haiti. But so far, the death toll, more than 700, is expected to rise, not as large as that in Haiti. We are hearing more and more from eyewitnesses. Ben Casnocha, an American living in Santiago, tells CBS News this morning.
I remember hearing my neighbor just across the way here yell out, gracias por Dios, thank you God, thank you God. And I think that was what most people were thinking at that time.
Earlier here on The Takeaway, we spoke to Charlotte Mountford, who was also in Santiago, and described it this way.
The whole apartment was just lurching. It wasn't shaking, it was lurching from side to side. I can't describe it, the fear. I was in absolute terror.
Chilean President Michel Bachelet has ordered a curfew and thousands of troops to the region, which has been rattled by more than 100 aftershocks.
We were joined earlier this morning by Daniel Vergara in Chillán, 70 miles east of Concepcion, and he told us what it was like to journey close to the epicenter.
Well, it was very, very impressive. I've taken that road. It's roughly a four-hour drive, 1,000 times in my life, but this is the first time that I've seen so much devastation, so many detours. All the pavement, all the highways were cracked, many buildings down, a lot of detours, but it was doable, and I had to come to see my family.
We'll hear more of the interview with Daniel Vergara in just a moment.
Here in the U.S., the White House is calling for a simple up or down vote on the health care bill, which would circumvent a Republican filibuster by a process called reconciliation. Republicans want to start from scratch. But President Obama's top health care official, Nancy Amdel-Parle, tells NBC News.
What is that really code for? Is that just code for let's not do anything? And I don't think that's what the American people want.
DeParle says the president may endorse reconciliation in the next few days.
We're learning more this morning about President Obama's nuclear weapons strategy. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that his plan includes permanently reducing America's arsenal by thousands of weapons, as well as narrowing the circumstances under which the U.S. would use them. Also this morning, President Obama is offering $900 million in grants to states and school districts to turn around low-performing schools and to cut the dropout rate. To get a share of the cash, schools would have to take drastic action, such as replacing principals, reopening schools as charter schools, or closing them outright. On the final day of the Winter Olympics, Canada upheld its national honor, the gold medal in the hockey game against the U.S.
Crosby up with it there. Punched along to Jerome McGinley. Crosby scores! It's over! The gold medal to Canada!
Festive atmosphere at last night's closing Olympic ceremonies. Overall, the U.S. won 37 medals, the most of any country in any Winter Games. Germany was second. I believe the Canadians were third, at least in the top five. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,325. The S&P opens at 1,104, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,238. Disaster can strike anywhere and anytime. How are the thoughts of the people in Chile affecting your preparedness for disaster? What do you take away from disaster and the circumstances that causes our lives to be turned upside down? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. It was a massive release of energy on Saturday, the earthquake in Chile, 8.8 magnitude on the moment magnitude scale, which measures energy, 500 times more powerful than the earthquake that killed 230,000 Haitians last month. Now you're listening to the sounds of people in Chile being confronted by water cannon as the police disrupt people trying to find necessities in the rubble. 2 million Chileans are estimated to be displaced and are waiting for assistance from the government. Here are some more voices from near the epicenter.
We ran up to the hill and we were there all night. We saw how the waves took everything and the noise was immense.
It's a woman speaking from the coastal region of Chile. They had an earthquake and a tsunami over the weekend. This man who was near the coast felt the earthquake and then waited for the waves.
It caught us off guard. We were sleeping. It didn't give us a chance to grab any of our things, not even a blanket. All we did was grab our kids and run up the hill.
There are sketchy reports of whether communications are off or on near the epicenter in Concepcion, which is believed to be the most severely damaged large population center. There have been multiple reports of shortages of gas and water as well, and as I mentioned, 2 million people are believed to be displaced by this earthquake, which began on Saturday. We spoke about it with BBC Chilean correspondent Gideon Long, who joined us from Santiago, and he reported on what the people of Chile are facing this morning.
There have been several aftershocks overnight of a magnitude of around 5. So those shocks are still continuing, obviously causing a lot of concern for those people down in the south who've been devastated by this quake.
And tell us about the damage of earthquake versus the tsunami. I mean, it was relatively minor. I mean, it was trivial, actually, out in the Pacific, where they were waiting for tsunami warnings, et cetera, in Hawaii and Indonesia and Australia. But close to the Chilean coast, it was a different story.
Absolutely. Some of the places have been very badly hit by the tsunami. Talcahuano, for example, which is one of Chile's major ports, it's the main port of the city of Concepcion, very, very badly hit. Huge waves came in there. It picked up fishing vessels and hurled them into the city's streets and squares. And smaller places as well. There have been villages up and down the coast, Dichato, Yoyue, Iloco, that have been basically destroyed completely by the waves that came in the wake of the tsunami.
We have you
in the wake of the quake.
We have you and the BBC to thank for those two voices from Ilyoko who are talking about how they were caught off guard by both the earthquake and the tsunami. Gideon Long, stay with us. I want to bring in Daniel Vergada, who's an industrial engineer who we were speaking at the top of the hour, who's from Chillen, which is 70 miles east of Concepcion, which is believed to be the closest large city to the epicenter. Daniel Vergada, why do you think there is so much of an ethic among Chileans to build buildings to withstand earthquakes? The death toll is tragic, but nothing like what we've seen in other earthquakes, particularly Haiti just a few weeks ago.
Well, good morning, everyone. I would say that it's mainly two reasons. This country, everyone knows, and every Chilean knows it since the moment they're born, that we live in a very, very, very seismic region. We all know that the faults, the Nazca plates, it's a known story for everyone, so everyone gets basic teaching, basic learnings from running away from earthquakes, staying under tables, under door frames, and that helped to limit the loss of lives. And the buildings, I mean, this same city, Chillen, my hometown, has been struck twice by very big earthquakes with epicenters very close to this city. And I'm actually standing now in what we call New Chillen, because the old Chillen was completely destroyed. This city was built from scratch like 50 years ago, which helped the city sustain the earthquake that we had now. I mean, mostly every major building is standing right now. And the second reason I would say is that we've had a very good laws and building codes. I mean, we've been very responsible about that. So I guess everyone followed them, and thankfully we have no major tragedies in the big cities.
Well, Daniel, you make an extraordinary point. There are many, many towns in Chile that have an old and a new based on earthquakes down through history. First of all, tell me, though, did you find your family safe when you finally got to Chillen? You made the arduous journey from Santiago to Chillen.
Yeah, well, fortunately, around 7 a.m. local time, that's about 3.5 hours after the earthquake, I could communicate with my family. Landlines were working very, very quickly. And at least then I took a deep breath and knew and my family was safe. They told me that our house was severely damaged. We had some roof tiles and some walls coming down, but nothing serious, thank God.
Well, that's great, and that's great to hear, and we hope that it stays that way. Gideon Long, a BBC Chile correspondent, the Chilean government has a reputation, for good or ill, of making the trains run on time. I suspect that's a bit of an asset here in a situation like this. How have the military and police been deployed to preserve order in places like Concepcion and the coastal cities?
Well, the security situation is basically being monitored by the police, apart from in the city of Concepcion. That's a special case where the army have been drawn in. President Bachelet drew up an emergency decree yesterday giving the army control over the city of Concepcion. That's where we've seen some of the worst looting as people try and find food, water, anything they can from the city's supermarkets. But that's an exception. Everywhere else in the region, it's the police that are in control. We had a curfew overnight in the Bio region, and the government says that was largely observed, although of course many people are sleeping outside, refusing to go back to their homes because of fear of the aftershocks. But they said that the curfew was largely observed. It seems to have been a relatively peaceful night.
And we expect Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to be visiting later on this week. Gideon Long, is it fair to say in any sense that this how the government deals with this is a test of civilian leadership in Chile?
Absolutely, I think it is. And once again, we're seeing President Bachelet rise to the occasion. She's, as you know, leaving office in 2 weeks' time. She's going out on a high, already very popular, and she seems to be handling the situation very well. Yes, Hillary Clinton will be here later this week. We're not sure exactly what the extent of her visit will be. It may be that she doesn't get any further than Santiago Airport. But this is a visit that was already programmed, and it is going ahead.
Gideon Long, BBC Chilean correspondent, who joined us from Santiago. We also spoke with Daniel Vergara, who is in Chian. He's an industrial engineer who found his family safe 70 miles from the epicenter. This morning, the tragedy might have you thinking of what if a disaster struck you. We want to check how these recent natural disasters have put things in perspective in your life. What takeaway is most important to how you're planning or thinking about the future? Give us your thoughts at 877-8MYTAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. And now let's check in on stories we're following at 15 minutes after the hour.
We've been talking all morning about the aftermath of the Chile earthquake, and half an hour ago we heard one chilling piece of testimony from writer Charlotte Mountford. She was in the capital, Santiago, when the quake struck on Saturday. Charlotte told us she was struck by the sound, or rather the lack of sound, of the earthquake.
The earthquake itself was silent, and that was what was so eerie. I expected a roar, I expected a rumble. It was just silent, rocking earth.
2 million Chileans are thought to be displaced. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will briefly visit Chile tomorrow. She is on a wider tour of Latin America. Back home, another twist in the health care story. The White House is calling for a simple up or down vote on the health care bill. That means bypassing Republicans using a process called reconciliation. There are reports President Obama may endorse the move in the next few days.
2,000 federal transportation workers won't have a job to go to today. The Transportation Department says they were furloughed because Republican Senator Jim Bunning blocked passage of a bill that would have extended federal highway and transit programs. The 2010 Olympics ended with a dazzling ceremony last night, complete with music, dance, and fireworks after the Canadian men's ice hockey team beat the USA to get the gold medal. U.S. forward Patrick Kane says this one was hard to take.
It was tough, and you know, we were on such a high after we tied it up, and then we go from that to losing in overtime, so it's pretty tough.
The U.S. had the most medals of any country with 37 medals in all. Germany came second with 30. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we talk with the U.S. ambassador to Chile for more on the relief efforts and American responses in just a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
I'm Lynn Sherrin for Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry, and we're talking this morning about Chile and the results of the earthquake there. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet has declared a state of catastrophe, and she has sent soldiers into some of the streets. Will that be enough? Will the country need U.S. help? Joining us now from the U.S. Embassy in Santiago, Chile, is Paul Simons, U.S. Ambassador to Chile. A career diplomat, he has served in that position for the past 2 years. Ambassador Simons, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway today.
Lynn, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you.
Give us your eye view of what's going on. What's the latest on the ground from Santiago? We know there have been aftershocks. Are you still feeling it?
Well, Lynn, this was obviously a major event. An 8.8 earthquake only occurs here once, once every 20, 25 years. On the other hand, this is a very seismically active country. Chile is accustomed to major earthquakes. In 1960, there was a 9.4 earthquake, and in 1985, another 8.1. So the capacity to respond here is very impressive. And so things are moving ahead. I think what we're recognizing in the last 24 hours is the situation on the ground in the Santiago area, in the capital area, has improved substantially. Government is operating normally today. Stores are opened. Electricity is being restored. We fortunately have been able to identify all our embassy employees, 100 Americans, 200 Chileans. They're all safe. But really the challenge is down south in the Concepcion area, the epicenter, and in that region. The devastation was certainly much greater than what was initially expected. For that reason, President Bachelet, I think, did two things very interesting yesterday and important. The declaration of the state of emergency, which allowed the military and the police to go in and restore order. And secondly, she did open up for the first time to the possibility of international support, because this is an event that really is of massive proportions.
And Mr. Ambassador, how much what should we know about the problems we heard where the police and the water cannons were brought in? Is that lawlessness being overblown, or was that in fact a serious problem?
Well, I think one thing you have to keep in mind is the whole Concepcion area has been without power, water, and telecommunications for about the past 48 hours. So, and also there's difficulty in terms of land transport. Under those kinds of situations, frequently you have outbreaks of lawlessness. So, for that reason, the state of emergency was declared.
Well, but Ambassador, just to elaborate,
beefing up security in those areas.
But just to make specific, you say land transport is a challenge. Is that because the bridges are out? Do the Chileans need help with airlifting? You know, what sort of lifelines are we talking about here?
Some of the bridges are out. That's correct. Some of the roads have faults in them, and they're having to make detours, make pontoons. So there's a major challenge in terms of sort of getting in and out of the Concepcion and Talca area. I don't think it's to the point now where they're air shipping in some supplies, but they're really looking to restore the land links. From a U.S. perspective, of course, our primary goal is to ensure the safety of the American citizens, particularly those in the Concepcion area, and that's where we've had a challenge because we haven't had much communication.
Because you can't get there.
And we may have as many as 1,000 Americans in the Concepcion area. We're not aware of any fatalities or serious injuries yet, but there are. But we have not been able to communicate with very many of our American citizens. We've reached out to them, but we have not had responses.
You are expecting Secretary of State Hillary Clinton later this week, a long-planned trip. Will the agenda get totally turned around? Will this all be about the earthquake, or are there other issues that you expect to deal with?
Well, certainly we're hoping that the Secretary will stop briefly by Chile during her swing through Latin America, and I would certainly expect that the response to the earthquake would be the number one item on the agenda at this point.
What does Chile want at this point, or could it use from the United States in terms of help?
Well, the Chileans do have a fair amount of their own capability. I think we need to remember they were among the first countries to supply search and rescue equipment and operatives to Haiti. So they have certain capabilities. They have a tremendous responsive capability, but I think what they perhaps recognized yesterday was that the magnitude of this earthquake was such that they would be in a position to also entertain offers from abroad. So in her public address yesterday, the president outlined a series of areas where Chile would be open to working with its international partners, and we are taking a close look. The President Obama spoke with President Bachelet on Saturday, and we're now actively examining how we could most effectively respond to Chile's needs in a number of areas where we have expertise.
And just briefly, Mr. Ambassador, every tragedy comes down to an individual. We saw those Olympic athletes in Vancouver. Can the Chilean athletes get home? The airport's okay?
The airport is right now, the international airport is not open for regular commercial traffic, but they're bringing some planes in. They're working very quickly to restore fuel supply at the airport. And so I would think they'll definitely find a way to get their athletes back home.
Ambassador Paul Simons, U.S. Ambassador to Chile, thank you. Stay safe down there.
Coming up.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the Chilean earthquake will certainly set the agenda in part for the U.S. government. We'll check the full agenda with Marcus Mabry and Rob Watson of the BBC in just a few minutes. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the week's agenda, what's going to be making headlines in the next few days. That's in a few moments, but right now let's check in on top news stories at about 30 minutes after the hour. More on the Chilean earthquake. The death toll in Saturday's massive 8.8 quake now stands at over 700, and that number is likely to climb in the coming days. But Chilean Consul General Patricio Dam at the United Nations says strong building codes prevented total devastation in Chile's cities.
The regulations in Chile for buildings are very, very tough. Now they prove that the regulations are good and they have worked.
Earlier this hour, we spoke to Gideon Long, the BBC's Chile correspondent in Santiago, who told us the ground is still shaking.
There have been several aftershocks overnight of a magnitude of around 5. So those shocks are still continuing, obviously causing a lot of concern for those people down in the south who've been devastated by this quake.
More than 100 aftershocks so far. The UN says Chile has asked for international aid. In other news here at home, the White House is now calling for a simple up or down majority rules vote on the health care reform bill. That means bypassing Republicans in a process called reconciliation.
A British insurance company is buying AIG's Asian unit for $35 billion. The deal has yet to be approved by the U.S. government, but the sale would lead to the biggest repayment yet of government bailout money from AIG. Meanwhile, a diamond as big as a chicken egg sold for $35 million over the weekend, breaking the record for the highest price ever paid for a rough diamond. It was discovered in a mine in South Africa and weighs 3.5 ounces. And now let's check the markets. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,325. The S&P opens at 1,104. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,238. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Rescue and recovery efforts
continue to hold Toyota's feet to the fire.
We've got to change those job-killing policies.
Just to give you a sense of perspective. What's going on?
So the agenda for this Monday morning, we're joined by Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Rob Watson joins us from London, BBC political correspondent in London. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, all.
So Marcus and Rob, first question, obviously, how is the earthquake, this devastation in Chile, going to set the agenda either for the international community or for the U.S. In the coming days, Marcus?
Well, for the U.S., it's interesting. You were just talking to the ambassador. It's the stark contrast between Chile and Haiti is remarkable. This is the worst natural catastrophe in Haitian history, in Chilean history, the president has said, the Chilean president has said, and yet you're talking about a death toll so far of less than 1,000 people. It's extraordinary, the difference. Haiti was not its worst ever natural disaster, but you're talking about a death toll there of 200,000. So it's much narrower role for the U.S. here than there was in Haiti, for instance.
And indeed, as we saw in Haiti, the disaster highlights both the good and the bad about the U.S.-Chilean relationship, right, Rob Watson?
Well, I guess to some extent, although I guess I'm agreeing with Marcus, really, that so far at least, certainly from the perspective of London and I presume from Washington, that there isn't quite the sense of running in to jump and fly in troops and aid. Although I suspect that what will happen in the long run, and I suspect it will be the same in Britain and the US, is that once the pictures start coming through, because we've been very short of pictures in London, once they do start coming through, that the charity will start flowing. Because it's extraordinary, you know, in my little town of Oxford, famous, of course, for its university at the school my kids go to, there is a Help for Haiti charity boxes in the school, and I took my kids to a birthday party recently when one of the parents said, don't buy a present, give some funds for Haiti.
So the connections are likely to emerge as the pictures emerge, and as we've been talking about, telecommunications is completely down near the epicenter, Concepcion. Marcus Mabry, in the news we were just reporting that the president is likely to endorse reconciliation on the health care reform bill this week. Lamar Alexander calls that a kamikaze mission for the Democratic Party. Is that a showdown?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know how many times Obama has been called a kamikaze. He's a little, kind of cold to be a kamikaze, one would think, usually. But it is a showdown. Look, the Democrats have somewhat like a kamikaze, perhaps, nothing to lose at this point. Certainly have more to lose politically by not going forward with health care reform after spending so much political capital on it than they do by going forward with it, even through a reconciliation process. And that's what's controversial here. It's the process by which you're going to get it done. But I think the Democrats face a much greater damage by not getting it done at all.
And reconciliation, we should remind people, is a simple majority vote on budget matters. They'll attach the health care reform bill to the budget issue there and avoid the 60.
It's a sneaky backdoor way of doing it, and they've done it for other bills.
And they have.
Right.
And the Republicans have done it.
Yeah,
and the Republicans will call it a nuclear option, but it's been used before.
And so it is majority rules.
There's also a lot of posturing going on this, and who knows, you know, if things will change as we get closer to the real vote.
Well, certainly some numbers are going to affect the agenda this week. Auto sales are going to be reported out for February. We're going to see Toyota's sales figures in light of everything we've been reporting for the last couple of weeks. What do you see?
Right. Well, you know, obviously Toyota's going to take a real hit here. The question to watch is who benefits from Toyota's hit. Between the weather, the really bad weather we've had on much of the country, which is going to depress sales further, and the Toyota news, it's going to be interesting to see, do American automakers benefit here, or does it go more to really the kind of Koreans who've been making this amazing kind of surge forward in American
Isn't there also a question, Marcus, about the long-term effect of the Toyota? I mean, Toyota buyers are very loyal.
Sure, that's absolutely right. And Toyota, you know, they didn't become the number one car company in the world for nothing. So this has really been a test of their reputation and their kind of wherewithal to withstand that.
But is there a response? I mean, if the figures go down, does it mean they're losing their loyal customers? Does it mean they all go to Korea? Does Ford inherit them?
The question is it short-term or long-term? We won't know that until we see
that. That we won't know. All right, so the day before the jobs report comes out, the House Foreign Affairs Committee plans on voting on a resolution that will recognize Armenian genocide by Ottoman Turks back in 1915. If this gets enough votes, it would then move to the House for a vote. Marcus, what's the political significance of this in the U.S.? And then I want to ask Rob what it means to the Turkish government.
It's a highly controversial topic. For many American politicians, when they're running for office, will say, oh, you know, the Armenian genocide, and they'll refer to it as a genocide. And yet when they're in office, and President Obama, I think, is guilty of this, they'll call it, they won't use that word genocide, they'll use that word atrocity instead. This is very important to Armenian Americans, and it's important also to Turkey. Turkey is a very important country.
And it's important to the history of the 20th century. It was one of the first examples of widespread ethnic cleansing, something that we talk about much more routinely when you get to the Yugoslavian period of time. Rob Watson, what do you think the significance is of this vote, and how closely are people in Europe and Turkey watching this?
Well, I should think they're watching it incredibly closely in Turkey. And all I would say just briefly on this subject is, you know, I remember from when I was in Washington and at the UN, the amount of effort countries like Turkey put into lobbying in Washington and elsewhere to prevent this kind of thing happening shows you just how much they care about it. I mean, the Turkey on the Armenian issue is one. I could think of lots of others. So I guess my comeback is, if you think about how much effort they put in trying to stop these things, you can guess how much they're not going to like it.
And nearly a century removed from the actual events.
I just want to say that when I was actually in Armenia and went to visit the genocide site, and the people there are so grateful when you do that because they feel that it's getting the word out. That
and
this
it is real. It's a place you can go and visit as opposed to some
sort of, you know, very moving rumor and innuendo.
Next Sunday, Iraq's going to hold its national elections, long delayed. But is this mission accomplished, Rob Watson?
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, won't we? I mean, it's extraordinary, certainly the way in Britain. It's difficult for me to gauge in the United States, but given how much blood and treasure and diplomacy and might and money has been spent there, how little attention is focused on the Iraqi elections. But look, it seems as though one hurdle has been just about kind of cleared, and that is an attempt previously to get an awful lot of Sunni political candidates banned, a court overturn that, so hopefully they will be standing, although there's a chance they'll be challenged afterwards. But I think the thing to really look out for is, you know, will we see a breakaway from the sort of sectarian nature of the politics that has dominated the post-invasion period?
Have they turned the corner there in Iraq? I guess we'll have to see. Thanks so much, Rob Watson, BBC political correspondent in London, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. Coming up, family life. Every Monday in our family segment, we talk about something. Today, empty nests not so empty when kids move back in with their parents later this hour. So February is gone, Lynn Scher. That means today, March 1st, is the beginning of Women's History Month.
Women's History Month, indeed, John. Thank you for knowing that.
I certainly don't want to think about the weather anymore. That's for sure.
No, this is a big one. And who better to kick off Women's History Month than Eve Ensler, who has been helping rewrite women's history and future for years. You probably know her best as the author of the smash hit The Vagina Monologues, or maybe you know her because she founded the movement V-Day to help end violence against women. Now she's got a new project and a new book about the lives of young women. It's called I Am an Emotional Creature, and it's a collection of fictional stories and monologues written from the perspective of teenage girls around the world. Eve Ensler joins us from her home here in New York. Hi, Eve.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you for being with us on this nice day.
Well, happy to be here.
So, Eve, you have given voice to abused women, to women who undergo plastic surgery, to all sorts of women. Why teenagers now?
Well, I think after traveling around the world for the last 12 years with V-Day, I was meeting and listening and watching so many lives of girls around the world. And it really began, a theme began to emerge kind of everywhere I went, that girls were kind of being pressured by cultural, familiar, societal mandates everywhere in the world to please someone. And it didn't matter if it was being, you know, in Westchester County and not having the perfect pair of purple Uggs, or whether it was girls starving themselves so they could look like an idea of what they were supposed to look like, or whether it was being in Kenya where girls were being forced to have female genital mutilation, or what, I mean, every society seemed to have some kind of pressure and some kind of mandate to control girls and determine girls. And I wanted to create a piece where girls were either addressing that, resisting that, not being able to resist that, and look at how we could help girls really be their authentic selves.
We keep hearing from scientists and others that teenagers are out of control, that there are all these raging hormones, we know about that, and that their brains are really underdeveloped as teenagers. Do you agree?
No, not at all. I actually think that teenagers are alive and awake and emotional and passionate and compassionate, and that their empathy is deeply awake. And I think that, you know, I know when I was a teenager, I was told every single day of my life, you're too intense, you're too alive, you're too emotional, you're too dramatic. I was even called Sarah Bernhardt. And so I tried to shut myself down and temper myself and censor myself.
And nobody really says that about you anymore, right?
Yeah, right.
Oh, no.
Eve, let me move on from the book for just a moment. I know you've got a very special mission you're also about to launch in the Congo. The mission is called City of Joy, where survivors of sexual violence after the horrible wars there can remake their lives. Give us a quick update on that. When is it actually opening?
It's opening in May, and it's going to be a place where women can turn their pain to power after they have suffered enormous suffering and pain and obviously atrocities in a war that's being fought over the minerals in the Congo. And people can get involved by going to vday.org and looking at the Congo site. there and really become a part of the movement to support women in the Congo taking back their destinies and their bodies and their minerals and their resources.
After a truly horrific experience for so many of them. Eve Ensler, the new book is called I Am an Emotional Creature. The project is City of Joy. Go on her website. Go on our website at thetakeaway.org. Learn about it. This one is truly remarkable. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Scherer in for Celeste Headlee, joining John Hockenberry. And coming up, we talk about family life just as we do every Monday. What happens when kids return to the nest? One-third of adult children live with their parents, and we'll find out why in a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories. The authorities in Chile have been struggling to provide food and water for thousands of survivors of Saturday's devastating earthquake. Some communities in southern Chile remain cut off, and President Michelle Bachelet has warned that the number of deaths is certain to rise. So far, authorities have confirmed just over 700.
This quake will also have economic aftershocks as well. To tell us more, we're joined by New York Times Wall Street and finance reporter Louise Story. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
So what are we expecting? I mean, this is one of the strongest economies in South America.
It is. So the damages are estimated to be $15 billion to $30 billion. And just to put that into perspective, John, Hurricane Katrina cost $40 billion in terms of insured losses here in the U.S. So it's close to Hurricane Katrina. The good news is that Chile's central bank has a very good reputation. What they've been doing since 2007 is Chile has been putting aside the extra money they make in copper in an offshore wealth fund that's gotten up to be $11 billion now. And by doing that, they've become a net creditor, not a net borrower. So if they need to go borrow some money now to clean this up, they're in pretty good shape.
Now, you mentioned copper there. Certainly, the repercussions for commodity prices are going to be one of the immediate impacts, right?
That's right. So a third of all copper in the world comes from Chile. The world's biggest copper company, Codelco, is based there. They closed down several mines this weekend. They've already opened some of them, but it did send copper prices up this morning on the London Metal Exchange. And we, you know, a lot of people think it'll send some more disruptions into the commodities exchanges till we see everything open up.
And copper in the last few months has been a real indicator of demand, industrial demand, and that's been depressed. So even if it does spike, do you think it's a long-term thing?
Right. Well, there is actually copper reserves. There is a big copper inventory. It's the highest it's been in 6 years of copper sitting around not being used. So there is some room for this disruption. It's just a question of how long it goes on for.
Louise Story from our partner, The New York Times. Staying abroad, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs during the war in the 1990s, Radovan Karadzic, has described the conflict as just and holy. He was speaking during the resumption of his trial in The Hague on 11 counts of genocide. One of the genocide charges relates to the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys back in 1995. Those are some of the stories we've been following this morning.
Roll out of the shadows and find adventure. There we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
Well, if the President of the United States does it, it has to be okay, right? We're talking about living with your parents or in-laws, and for this week's family segment, we're talking about this growing trend. But we are not just talking about, as Mr. Obama does, having the first mother-in-law there. According to a study by the AARP, one-third of all 18 to 49-year-olds also live at, well, home. That is, their parents' home, otherwise known as their back. Here to share statistics on who's doing it and tips on how to make the most of this situation is Yolanda Gold-Cavanis, a longtime family and parenting journalist whose work regularly appears in Redbook and iVillage. Kristen L'Esperance of Burlington, Vermont, also joins us. She is a 30-year-old interior architect who was forced to move back in with her parents last year due to underemployment. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Yolanda, let me start with you. 33%, big number. Is that bigger than ever with these 19 to 49-year-olds moving back in?
Well, you know, it's kind of back to the future. It's not bigger than ever. When you think about it, generations ago, this was quite common to have several generations under one roof. We've gotten away from that, of course, so it's the biggest it's been in a very long time. And I think, as Kristen would probably attest, the economy is largely to blame.
Economy is almost totally to blame. Kristen, let's go right to you. You are living with your parents.
I am.
How do you feel about it?
It's rough. It's rough. You know, obviously, one of the most discernible benefits of it is, you know, I'm just finished graduate school and, you know, no job, no money. So, as my father said, at least you're not living under a bridge somewhere. But other than that, it's been a struggle, I think, for both of us.
What's tell me, first of all, some of the benefits they've got other than the fact that you're not paying rent. Is it okay to be with your folks for a little while now? Never mind. I withdraw that question. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on to the biggest problems. I mean, are you feeling like a teenager? Do you have a curfew and stuff like that?
Well, I don't have a curfew, but you know, some of the sort of conventions of high school are sort of happening a little bit in terms of if I'm not going to be home, I need to call and, you know, let them know. And it's more of an adult negotiation now, but the reality is I'm sharing a car with my mother and we're all sharing a bathroom. And I've been living, you know, in New York for the last 4 years, and so pretty distant physically.
Yeah,
so that's, now we're all together.
That's tough. Yolanda, Kristen is an example of one of the things that's going on. But not to make really to make too light of all this, are there some benefits to having someone of the younger generation moving back in with the folks?
Oh, there are huge benefits. I mean, as Kristen explains, we can all see the drawbacks. I mean, especially if you're going back to your childhood bedroom, you know, you can't help but kind of revert back to that child-parent dynamic. But the benefits are huge of having multi-generations under one household. I mean, we learn from one another. Parents at that age really do want in, even if it's difficult sometimes to give in to that and to live with that. They want to be a part of your lives. And if you have children, and that's part of the mix, I know Kristen doesn't, it's a wonderful built-in babysitting network. The children love to spend time with their grandparents, and it's beneficial to them as they learn about their past and history in general.
And Yolanda, I mean, for much of American history, the extended family was the support network
for all kinds of people. We've moved far away from that. So, I mean, I have to say, as much as I know it must be uncomfortable for you, Kristen, I have three kids, and I'm thinking, Mama, please come home.
Yeah, but what about, okay, I like the grandparenting and the babysitting idea, but I'm now putting myself in the mind of the parents and saying, hold it, we just got this empty nest, and I want a little space myself. I'm the older generation.
You know what's really important here? You've got to have the talk. And that means that early on, and it's never too late, it's great to do it before the whole thing gets in motion, but you need to sit down and talk about boundaries. You need to sit down and talk about the financial arrangement. If there's no money contribute, what will you be contributing instead of money? Maybe there's some certain chores you'll be taking over on a regular basis. You really want to set it up so that you have a roommate situation, because, I mean, if you have a roommate, you know that there's certain common areas, you know that there's certain times that person uses the kitchen, and there's certain times.
Well, we got to find out, though. Kristen, have you had the talk?
We have had the talk, and it's a lovely idea having a roommate. But the reality is my parents, you know, they're approaching retirement, and are we all going to move to Florida? You know, it wasn't in the plan. So I think it's a challenge. And of course they want to be able and are glad that they're able to do it for me. But, you know, none of us a year ago thought that this is what the future was going to hold. And hopefully it isn't.
It isn't. Kristen, just curious, do you contribute at all to the food? I know you're not paying rent, but what is your role in expenses there?
It's non-existent at this point.
Okay, well, so you're waiting to get re-employed, which we all hope everybody will do.
Well, you're an interior architect. You could at least, like, work on the furniture in the living room, right?
Every parent home needs a redo. They're probably stuck in the 70s.
Yeah, right. John is sitting here anticipating what's going to happen in 20 years or so, and his brood, long gone, moves back in with them. He wants your tips, Yolanda. Yolanda Galt-Cavanis, longtime family and parenting journalist, thanks for joining us. Also, Kristen L'Espérance of Burlington, Vermont.
Should have taken some notes there. If you have a not-so-empty nest story, we'd love to hear it. If you moved back in with your parents, did you do it because of the economy and do it reluctantly? And if you're a parent, how do you make sure that the return to the nest isn't a permanent one?
About 20 years ago, when I was in my late 20s, I had the reverse situation happen. I actually had my mother and my teenage sister move in with me. They were relocating to the city where I was living, and their housing wasn't ready. We had the talk, and it didn't work. The apartment immediately became my mother's house, and it was pretty uncomfortable. So, in theory, it's a good idea to have the talk, but it doesn't always work, unfortunately.
Tell us your story, good or bad, at 877-8MYTAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. And this morning, the tragedy in Chile might have you thinking about what if a disaster struck you or your neighbors? What is most important to your life, and how are these disaster stories putting your life in perspective? Give us your thoughts at 877-8MYTAKE or at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.